Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. 26 million Americans suffer from asthma, a condition in which airways narrow and swell and produce extra mucus. It can make breathing difficult and trigger coughing, wheezing, and shortness of breath. Asthma can't be cured, but it can be controlled. In fact, a new study conducted by the Medicaid managed care company AmeriHealth Caritas, based in Philadelphia, has found what seems like a simple way to better treat asthma patients: more human interaction and follow-up. Joining us to tell us about the study and asthma, Dr. Andrea Gelzer, the Senior Vice President of Medical Affairs, and registered nurse Karen Michael, both of AmeriHealth Caritas. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. If you have a question or comment you'd like to leave on Facebook, you can do that on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. More human interaction. Okay, I know that is putting it very simply, and it sounds like a simple solution to not curing, but better treating a condition that so many Americans suffer from. So give me a little more information, Dr. Gelzer. What do we mean by more human interaction?
It's connecting. It's really connecting with, for us, a member in a low-income, vulnerable individual. Who's on Medicaid and who has a chronic disease. And it's really engaging and respecting.
But when you say connecting, that makes it sound like it's not happening now. And again, it sounds so simple.
I think historically, managed care companies and many healthcare entities did a lot of care management and tried to optimize the care for individuals living with chronic diseases like asthma. But a lot of it was done over the telephone. And just simply doing it over the telephone doesn't work. And you have to really get out into the communities where especially people with asthma live, because there are so many environmental triggers for asthma. You have to get out there, you have to connect with them, and you have to show them. Many individuals with asthma, and in our population, one of the reasons we did the study was we had a very high, it's very important that somebody with asthma uses their inhalers. So there are dispensed inhalers, and there are dispensed inhalers for when they have an asthma attack, and they're dispensed inhalers to control and stop them from having asthma attacks. And many individuals, when they feel better, they stop using their controller medication. And studies have shown that really getting in the physician's office or having someone, an asthma educator, show someone how to use the inhaler with a spacer device and really educate on the importance of having an asthma control plan really makes a difference.
So that's really what you're talking about, is education and follow-up that, well, Karen, let me ask you, does this occur, this human contact? I mean, we know it occurs with staff, with nurses, with doctors, in the hospital setting when someone has been admitted to the hospital with an asthma attack or suffering from asthma. But what you're talking about, for the most part, and correct me if I'm wrong, is this is after a person with asthma leaves the hospital and, just as Dr. Gelzer described, may not be doing what they should be doing because they feel better.
Yes, if they stop taking their controller medications because they're starting to feel better, then they will be more prone to having an attack. But additionally, it's not just about the care they get in the hospital or when they're seeing the physician in the office. It's being able to work with that member in their home and take a look around the home to see what triggers are present. You know, are there insect infestations that can be treated? Are there pets in the home that maybe the member didn't tell the physician about? And simple strategies like keeping the cats out of the bedroom can really help the child not trigger for asthma attacks. So being able to get our community health navigators into the member's home and work one-on-one with the families and show them simple strategies to help keep some of the triggers down is very effective as well.
But what's unique about this? I mean, this would seem to say that beyond asthma, that with any condition, any kind of chronic disease, that if there was more follow-up, if there were healthcare professionals coming into the home and looking around, looking at the environment, reminding someone to take their medication, that there would be more successful outcomes.
And that's very true. One of the philosophies that we are working to bring forward within our model of care is bringing care closer to the member. And that involves leveraging workforces that can get out in the community and work directly with members in the home, helping them understand what they've been told by the physician and applying that in their daily life so that they can control their chronic conditions. We use a lot of non-clinical staff to go out into the home and to work one-on-one with members, and then we have clinical resources that we can bring in to supplement that when there are issues around medication reconciliation or understanding drug interactions that need a clinical person to educate.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Garza, you want to say something?
Yeah, I just wanted to add to what Karen said it's absolutely right, and that is that you will get the optimal outcome when you expend a lot more resource and engage with the individual. That said, about 1 in 5 individuals in Pennsylvania are covered on Medicaid. You can't expend the same amount of resource on every individual. So you gotta pick your battle, so to speak, and you've gotta engage with impactable conditions and individuals who will benefit from the resource being expended, from the interaction.
Who are these individuals now? Your company, AmeriHealth Caritas, you are a Medicaid managed care company. A lot of your patients are low incomes, vulnerable populations. Is that mostly who you are treating or that you're dealing with?
All of the individuals that we interact with and have as members are vulnerable. They're all in government programs.
So, why are they more vulnerable to asthma attacks or problems with asthma than, say, someone who's not involved or not on a government program?
It's access to care.
Okay.
It's access to care. It's living conditions. If you don't have a lot of money and you're living in a city in low-income housing, or if you're exposed to different particulates because of the housing you're in, or you don't have your medication because you don't have access to your medication, it's going to exacerbate any condition.
We have a phone call from someone who does want to talk about the cost. Kathy is in Lancaster. Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
Yes.
I have asthma, and I need Breo Ellipta, I think it's called. And right now, I am very blessed because my health insurance covers it 100%. It's over $300 a month. And then I take, Avastin as well, which is generic, and that's only $10. But we went on to the healthcare.gov to sign up for our insurance for next year, and I could not find a plan that we could afford that would cover that. So now I'm going to have to go back to my doctor, ask him if he has something different, or I can't afford it. And so I think that's one of the problems. People, you don't have the symptoms and you can't afford the medication, so you just can't get it.
Mm. Hey, thank you very much for your call. The point that Kathy does bring up is kind of in line with what we were just discussing, that it sounds as if the medication, that some of the things that those with asthma, suffering from asthma, need is very expensive.
They can be. Medications, some of the brand medications can be very expensive, but we really try to focus on some of the simple strategies to also help members. Medication, taking them faithfully, is very important, but so is avoiding tobacco smoke. So is avoiding pet dander, if that's one of the triggers that you have. So having the asthma action plan that Dr. Gelzer mentioned is critical too, so that the member knows what their particular triggers are, what they have to avoid, and what strategies they have to take around their medication so that they don't end up having an exacerbation and ending up in the ER.
So asthma action plan, that sounds different than in the past. I mean, what I'm picturing is someone goes to their family physician, and there's a prescription for medication and inhaler. They maybe know what sets them off. Maybe they don't know what brings on an episode. But an action plan sounds as if there's a lot more to it than just go to the doctor, get a prescription. Okay, when I have an attack, this is what I do. Is that an accurate way to describe this?
Yeah, you can't. Medications are important, and for the caller, the medications. Every plan has different medications, but I'm sure if you work with your physician, they will be able to work with the plan to ensure that you get the medications you need to keep you out of the hospital. That said, asthma action plans. It's all about behavioral change, really, and controlling different elements in somebody's environment that can be changed.
Mm-hmm. What are some of those?
Oh,
I know there's a whole list.
Yeah, caring.
I know there's a whole list, but what are some of the most common ones?
Pet dander is one. So cats and dogs are set off some individuals with asthma. Tobacco smoke is huge. Air quality in general is big. In large cities and multi-dwelling buildings, cockroach dander is also a huge trigger.
Yeah,
dust mites.
I saw something in researching this that cockroach dander was one of the big ones, especially in some urban areas, that mm-hmm. it is a big one. I mean, it when you read it, you think, ew, that's gross, but it is an issue when there are cockroaches around.
Absolutely. And it may not be your apartment. It may be the apartment next to you. Mm-hmm. But the reality is, if they're in the building, you're going to be affected.
I want to get back to Kathy's question, though, and this kind of goes back to what you're trying to head off. You know, she said that her medication costs $300 a month. We've heard stories, and usually it's having to do with older people. But in her case, I mean, she's, you know, still working, and still doesn't sound like she's retirement age or anything, that if the medication costs that much, you can see people saying, you know what, I'm going to hold off. I'm not going to use this. I'm going to make it last. And that goes back to what can actually trigger a problem in that they don't take the medication or don't do what they're supposed to do on a regular basis because they can't afford it.
Well, that's why it's so important to have the plan and so important to discuss with your provider whether or not there's another medication, a generic medication instead of a brand medication, that's been proven to be just as effective. You may think you're controlled on one, because one, you've been on one drug that's very expensive for a long time, but there may be other drugs out there that will work equally as well.
Mm-hmm. What prompted the study?
Well, we have so many moms and babies in our plans, and children with asthma, and lots of emergency room visits that cost the Commonwealth lots of money, and lots of inpatient hospitalizations. And when we started to mine our data, looking for things we could impact to improve outcomes for asthma, we saw that many of our members were not taking prescribed inhalers and other medications. For whatever reason, they got it prescribed once and then they never picked it up again. Mm. So we really look to increase medication adherence because that's so important for individuals with asthma.
But that hospital readmittance, that is big, isn't it? I mean, it is very costly. And let's face it, someone who suffers from asthma, almost anyone, would rather be at home and be healthy than to be in a hospital. But cost is a big factor. Have you seen any results, any difference in readmittance to hospitals as a result of your study?
As a result of the study, and we did this both in the Philadelphia area through our Keystone First plan and also in this area through our AmeriHealth Caritas Pennsylvania plan. And so in both different areas in Pennsylvania, we saw very significant reductions in both hospital admission rates and emergency room visits. So it's hugely important from a quality of life perspective and also from a cost perspective.
How significant?
I think we're talking millions of dollars in our plans. And that's significant.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk more about this in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest today, Dr. Andrea Gelzer, the Senior Vice President of Medical Affairs, and Registered Nurse Karen Michael, both of AmeriHealth Caritas in Philadelphia. They do have patients here in central Pennsylvania as well. We're talking about a new study that addresses what works better. Better outcomes, and by better outcomes, we mean not as many people readmitted to the hospital who have asthma. Very simple solution, more human interaction and following up with taking your medication, having an asthma action plan. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's go to Claire in West Penn. Claire, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. I just wanted to make some comments about studies I've heard of or read in the past, I don't know, 10, 20 years, about diesel smoke from trucks or cars, and the fact that diesel has particulate or particles that can enter the lungs and cause problems. Now, I know that, you know, the trucking lobby over the years has probably fought that, but do you know of any initiatives to try and clean up the diesel problem with, especially in the cities where there are more trucks than maybe out in the country?
All right. Thank you very much for your call. You know anything about that?
Certainly, it's an issue with particulates, but I think that I do believe that the government has generally put a lot of regulatory force around the use of diesel at this time.
What, yeah. If you would define a particulate? What are we talking about?
It's a it's a microscopic solid. Like a piece of dust that actually you inhale in, and you inhale through your nose, and there are different physical barriers there. But if you inhale enough of that stuff, some of that stuff gets down into your bronchial, you know, tubes and into your lungs, and can really precipitate an allergic reaction.
Let's take a step back and define some of these things. What is asthma?
What is asthma? Asthma is reactive airway disease. So you have trouble getting air out of your lungs. And we call it asthma because it's still reversible. It's reversible by removing the offending allergen or by taking a medication to control it.
Now, you've pretty much defined the causes of it when we're talking about. What about allergies? I was about to use the word allergic, but what about allergies? Does that contribute to allergies, or excuse me, to asthma in some ways?
Allergens do contribute in some individuals. I mean, you can have asthma from a number of different reactive causes.
Why do some people get asthma and others don't?
That's a wonderful question, and I don't think anyone has an answer to that.
But, I mean, is there any, say, a narrowing of the airways, but, I mean, everyone is taking in a lot of these same, particulates, and, you know, some of the triggers that there are out there, but some people will have asthma will react to it and others won't. Do we know why?
Sometimes it's genetic. Sometimes it's the degree of exposure. It's the degree of exposure. And if you look at the prevalence rates in the United States, I think it's about 8.7%, something like that. Actually, in Pennsylvania, it's a little bit higher. And if you go into the city in Philadelphia and you look at African Americans in Philadelphia, you're probably hitting around 12%. So, you know, it's how much exposure you've had.
Well, see, it doesn't surprise me that Pennsylvania is high because, in recent years, we've heard, you know, it surprises many people that actually here in central Pennsylvania that we have some of the worst air in the country. because of those particulates that are out there. Philadelphia, as an urban area, a city, that's not surprising either. But I think we're in the top 10, the state is, as far as some of the dirtiest
air. Right, and I think Harrisburg also hits
Central Pennsylvania. Yeah. Harrisburg, Lancaster, two of the dirtiest areas in the country. And when we have talked about this and those studies have come out, one of the first things we often hear is those who suffer from asthma are most impacted by that dirty air. You know, I know I've heard people say, well, I don't have asthma, so what does it matter to me? 26 million people in this country with asthma. 3,500 people a year die from asthma. How do you die from asthma?
If your airways are closing and filling with mucus and you're not able to exchange air, you literally suffocate to death, and you're trying to breathe and you can't get enough oxygen and sustain your body. And it's not a pleasant death at all, and it's preventable. And that's one of the reasons that controlling asthma is so important.
When you say it's not a pleasant death, I picture it as being very violent.
It can be, absolutely. Mm-hmm. You're struggling to breathe.
Mm-hmm. How about screening and prevention? Okay, prevention you've talked a little bit about. What about screening and diagnosis, I should add, too?
It's really about open communication with your physician, talking about symptoms, looking for things like children who are waking at night coughing, and making sure that your physician knows about things like that so they can do the testing that would identify whether or not the child has asthma.
Mm-hmm. From the statistics I've seen, I have to admit, I was a little bit surprised by this. There are more adults with asthma than children, correct? I don't know. Dr. Gelser, you have a look on your face like you don't know if that's right or not.
There are lots of adults with asthma.
Okay.
But there are lots of children with asthma as well. And remember, well, think about it. It's the degree of exposure. How many times have you been exposed? So you may, there probably are more adults with asthma.
There are some that say you grow out of it, or that, that somehow you have asthma as a child, but you don't as an adult. Is that...
You may have mild asthma. You may have severe asthma. It's a continuum, of gradation.
Mm-hmm.
And so you may have been allergic to cats when you were a kid, and you wheezed, and you showed up in the emergency room once or twice. But once you stayed away from cats, you didn't have that issue anymore.
So you think almost I'm cured, when really there is no cure.
Well, it's not that there's no cure. I mean, it's really...
It's a behavioral thing.
It's a behavioral thing, and it's an environmental thing.
Mm. Let's take a call from Dan here in Central Pennsylvania. Dan, you're on the air.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
I was just curious how a person's diet affects their asthma, as far as, I guess it's like a lot of other illnesses, diseases. I'm guessing if a person has an unhealthy diet, they're going to have more problems. And it sounds like asthma is caused by a lot of bad things in the environment, chemicals and things like that. Well, our body has the capability, to the best of my knowledge, to take care of a lot of them things if you have a healthier diet.
All right. Thank you very much. Diet have anything to do with this?
You can have a food allergy, but there are the more likely way that you develop asthma is exposure to the dust mite or the cockroach, or the particulate matter in the air.
But the point he's making, I think, is good advice overall. A healthy
Absolutely.
Diet,
a healthy diet for any chronic, to prevent the onset of any chronic disease, is very important.
Although I do understand that these statistics are from the Centers for Disease Control, that there are more people who are obese who suffer from asthma than are not obese.
Yeah, I'm not aware of any associations that show a correlation there. There may be data that shows prevalence, but there's no cause and effect data out there that I've seen.
And that may go back to Dan's advice, if you will, about having a healthy diet, living a healthy lifestyle.
Certainly, healthy
and
physical activity. It's all important.
And
keeps your immune system strong, which helps you fight off reactions, which can help you with any chronic illness.
You know, Dr. Gelser, though, I was just thinking about something. Activity, people going outside. What happens if is causing your asthma or contributes to it or triggers it is outside?
Well, and there are some individuals that exercise induces the actual asthma attack. But again, you get back to that asthma control plan that you're working on with your provider. Talk to your provider. It's very important. Physical activity is very important, as Karen said, for the immune system and to prevent a whole host of diseases.
Mm-hmm.
There is no reason why you can't figure out a way by using an inhaler before you exercise to actually... The benefits of exercise are going to outweigh the danger of exercising.
That's good to hear.
Yeah.
We're almost out of time for this portion. I want to thank both of you for being with us today, coming up from Philadelphia. What do you want people to take away from the study, what we've talked about here today? What's the takeaway? What do you want people to know?
Really, the importance of taking the medication that you and your physician have talked about and that he or she has prescribed. You know, even when you feel better, you still need to take those controller inhalers because that's what's going to keep your lungs healthy and avoid the flare-ups that will end you up in the emergency room.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Gelser?
And I'm just going to add, we're a managed care organization, and I want to put a plug into the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth really has had really smart and proven strategies to expand Medicaid funds to managed care organizations and allow us to innovate. And that innovation is really, you see the fruits of our study and the simplicity of our interactions and the things we did to get those outcomes.
Have you seen, since the state has expanded Medicaid, have you seen better outcomes with asthma patients?
I don't know that the better outcomes are related to the expansion of Medicaid. Certainly being able to extend our interventions to that population has helped that population. But, you know, outcomes really are a matter of being able to implement the programs. And as Dr. Gelser said, having the funding and the backing from the state to do that has made it possible for us to continue to innovate.
And the data do show that having access to care, having insurance, actually does decrease.
And I would also add to that, I'm not going to answer the question for you, but just make a suggestion that this is one of those things when people, there may be some people who say, well, why are taxpayers doing this? Well, because in the long run, taxpayers are saving money, correct?
Absolutely. Healthcare is an essential function. If people aren't healthy, they can't help grow the economy. That's what I would say.
Dr. Andrea Gelser, the Senior Vice President of Medical Affairs, Registered Nurse Karen Michael, both of AmeriHealth Caritas, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, a contest that allows you to redraw congressional boundaries. And boy, that should be a lot of fun. That's coming up on tomorrow's show. Republican State Representative Brian Cutler is the newly elected House Majority Leader, the first House leader from Lancaster County in almost a century. He joins us today to talk about priorities and issues. Representative Cutler, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I have to admit that I was a little bit surprised that Lancaster County has not had a majority leader or someone in leadership in almost a century. One of the most populated counties in the state and has sent a lot of people to Harrisburg who serve for a long time. So that has to be an honor for you.
It certainly is. It's humbling to have both the backing of back home for the job and then the backing of the caucus to be the majority leader. We have been blessed. We've had lots of other leadership positions from Lancaster County. We've had several appropriations chairmen in the Senate and in the House, as well as some of the other positions. But it has been a while since we had a leader or a speaker. And Lancaster newspapers did a really nice historical perspective.
Yes, they did.
And pulled up pictures of everybody. And I enjoyed reading it because I'm a little bit of a history buff. So it was neat to see the background, if you will, on each of those individuals and where they were from and how they served.
What does that background, what does your upbringing, your background bring to, first of all, the House and now a leadership position?
Well, I think the natural starting point, and I've talked a lot about this because of my personal history and losing both of my parents to Lou Gehrig's disease at a young age, and the support that the community gave me and my sister at that time, it certainly was... It allowed us to have still somewhat of a normal childhood. So there's certainly a sense of indebtedness to our community for even giving me this opportunity, because without their help, you know, more than 30 years ago, I wouldn't have been in a position to go to trade school and eventually college and then law school and then run for office. So there's a sense of indebtedness there. There's also just some good, honest work ethic. That's probably what Lancaster County is known about. You know, we work hard. We always try to make things better than they were when we started. And then we also, I think it goes without saying, we treat everyone with respect. I know that some of the issues that I've worked on have been controversial, but I think if you go back and look at my legislative approach, for example, you know, we were able to do welfare reform. We were able to do other bills where not only did they pass, they had a Democrat as a co-lead prime sponsor, and they most of them passed unanimously. You know, you look at something like the welfare reform bill with the LIHEAP program, the Low Income and Heating Energy Assistance Program. That's a bill that is very timely right now, and that program had a lot of fraud. Auditor General Jack Wagner had found that. Myself and Representative Ron Waters had worked on the bill, and it took a while, but it ultimately was passed. We had lobbying reform myself and Representative Newman worked on. So I think that kind of hard work, common sense approach has paid dividends in the legislative field, and more importantly, for the benefit of the Commonwealth. So those are the kinds of work qualities and ethic that I'll bring to the position.
The people you just mentioned are Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
When we look at Washington right now, it seems as though it's very toxic. How do you keep Harrisburg? Now, you as one person probably cannot, but you're in a leadership position. How do you keep Harrisburg from becoming toxic? And by that, I mean that everything is so partisan, is hyper-partisan. How do you keep Harrisburg from becoming that?
Well, I think it starts with personal relationships and getting to know individuals. One of the things I tried to do as whip, not just with my own members, but even many of the Democrat members, I try to figure out where they're from. Just like me, and how my upbringing influenced my perspective on the world. For example, when we were in need, it was the community, it was the church, it was our friends, our neighbors, our family that rallied around us. So in that regard, in Lancaster County, we have that kind of social safety net. So it certainly, for me at least, it influences my belief that the community and the locals are best able to provide that assistance, not government. But I also recognize that not everybody has the same experience. Not everybody had the ability to go to a good public school like I did and where my own kids now go. So you know, I recognize that there's a difference in experiences that influence a different in outlooks and approach. So part of it's just understanding where folks are coming from. Recently in an interview with John Micek, I referenced that. It said, it doesn't matter where we start. It's where we end up that matters.
John Micek, Penn Live.
Correct.
Opinion page editor. You know, many times when we talk about the divide, we talk about political parties. But let's face it, here in Pennsylvania, we have urban areas, Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, other cities. But we have a lot of rural areas, and those interests are often not the same. You mentioned Representative Waters, for example. I believe he's from Philadelphia.
He was, yes.
Yeah. So, again, how do you bridge that divide when you have people that just have distinct differences and priorities?
Well, for me personally, I always approach the issue itself, and I kind of refer to it as distillation. You get the broader issue, you know, welfare fraud, LIHEAP fraud, and with Representative Waters, we work down to what was the least objectionable part that they could get the most done and we both could still support.
That sounds like a compromise.
It is. It absolutely is. And myself and Pam DeLisio, who's also from Philly, we worked on the hospital licensing bill, which your prior guest probably would have been interested in because it dealt with deemed approval. I always thought it was silly that as a hospital administrator, when I worked there, we would go through an inspection with the federal government. And then usually 3 to 6 months later, the state would come through and essentially do the same inspection. And what was happening by doing it that way was that the waiting list for actual complaints was growing. So we were able to say, if you pass the higher of the two standards, which is the federal, you're deemed to have passed the state licensing protocols, and then we could focus our inspectors on actually tracking down complaints and improving patient safety as opposed to just filling out paperwork. And that's an issue that predated both Representative DeLisio and I. I was told that when individuals had been working on that, it had been 30 years. They've been trying to find a compromise. And I think it's absolutely possible. It takes a lot of hard work, but it's very doable. And it's just a matter of getting in there and understanding that perspective.
I want to get into some issues in just a moment. Before I do, though, as someone in leadership, how do you weigh the priorities of your constituents, because you're an elected representative from Southern Lancaster County, the priorities of your constituents versus the needs and the priorities of the Republican Party in the majority?
Now, that's an excellent question, actually, because I often say I have two constituencies now. I have the folks back home who, you know, live in the 100th district, and I'm blessed and privileged to represent. But then I've also got the caucus up here, and I would actually throw in a third one, and that's the responsibility to govern, because we actually have to find solutions. So in that regard, I'm probably a little more pragmatic when it comes to approaching solutions, and I'll give you an example, and it dealt with the expansion of gaming. That's something that personally I've never been supportive of myself, because my area is not. But as whip, I knew that it had enough votes to pass because it's my job to count the votes and understand where folks are. So when I recognized that the state was going a different direction, they were going to pass a bill. I was one of the legislators who lobbied heavily for the ability to opt out at a local level, because at least that way we could self-govern and self-choose where we wanted to go. And, you know, that was something that it was not an easy decision for me, but recognizing that it was in the best interest of my constituents to get that part in there for them. And it goes back to what you mentioned earlier. I view that as a compromise. It was something that protected our area, gave us the ability to self-select, but then also it allowed the state to pursue the course that it was going to pursue anyway.
So let's talk about some issues. What are the priorities when the legislature comes back into session in 2019?
Well, I think when you look at the House, there's certainly been substantial turnover. You know, we're going to have 40 new members. About half of them are Republican. And so there's going to be a whole new list of priorities that come in. So there will always be a get-to-know-you period with the new members. You know, obviously, I'm getting to know them now, but once we get to the floor and get committees assigned and chairmanships and those sorts of things, that will accelerate. So part of it's understanding what everybody's new priorities are. Sometimes those are influenced by elections. Sometimes those are influenced by specific local issues that have come up in the interim. But when you look back, I think the natural starting point is probably whatever was unfinished from last session. You know, there were several bills that were vetoed. One dealt with career and technical education. That's something that I'm particularly passionate about myself because of my own background, being an X-ray tech. And one dealt with the state debt reduction. I would love to find out why exactly the governor vetoed both of those and hopefully work towards a compromise on those, because I think that good financial management and good career opportunities for individuals coming out of school are both worth pursuing. So if we can figure out what the reasons were for the veto and perhaps bridge that, I think that would be a good starting point.
I talked to the governor on Friday, by the way,
at
the governor's residence, but I'll ask him.
All right. Very good. I appreciate the assistance. But then, so you've got career and technical packages. I think that's something that we should be looking at. For me, it was a great career. I was able to pursue college and my law degree ultimately based on both of those by being an x-ray tech. And I love the technical side of the job. And I think too often we don't notify students that that's even an option. And I remember myself when I told my guidance counselor that I was going to a tech school, that she strongly encouraged me to go to college. She said, you can't, you have to go to college. Your grades are too good. And my family circumstances with losing my parents, my dad died my senior year, as I mentioned earlier, I just wasn't in a position to go to college at that time. I had a household to help run and a younger sister to help and still care for my mother. So when you recognize that everybody's life experiences are a little different, I think that that's important. And career tech education is a great path for many, many folks. Mm-hmm. The debt reduction, I think that's something that we have to have a serious discussion about. And we have to put our financial house in order. Obviously, the budget is something that dominates from now until June as we move forward. And I think getting the debt payments under control is part of that. Personally, I'm a big fan of Dave Ramsey in terms of like obliterating debt and getting rid of it. I think that that's something that we should be working towards as a state to limit our debt so that we can then reallocate those dollars to actual programs, not paying for things that already have passed. And I think education will continue to be a focus because it's so important. It's the great equalizer, I believe. You know, as I mentioned, I'm a product of public education. I give my teachers a lot of credit because they were the ones who invested in me at a very, very early time.
Let me ask you about education.
Sure.
To follow up. Governor Wolf ran for in his first term. One of his main promises was to increase funding for education. That has happened with the assistance of the legislature, obviously, over the past 4 years. He will propose his budget in February, and it's probably a pretty good bet that there will be asking for more funding for education. Will Republicans go along with that?
Well, I think when you look at the last four budgets, and I think the numbers are important, it was over $1 billion extra that went into education. Now, the governor only signed the last budget. So while he can take credit for increasing education, it really was the legislature that took the lead on each of those four budgets, not just the last one. In terms of where we're going to go, I think it's important to look at it because pension costs continue to rise. There'll probably be several $100 million of additional expense there. So while we don't like to talk about it, that is an investment in education because it's paying for the teachers.
It has to be done.
And it absolutely has to be done because that debt continues to grow. The problem usually comes down to the nuances between, does investing in education mean putting more room into the classroom or more money into the pension, or like where does it go? I think that education will certainly get more money. I'm not sure it'll be exactly where the governor wants.
$100 million has been we've been looking at over the last 4 years. Do you think that that's doable? Maybe will your caucus support that?
Well, looking at the IFO report, they're saying that we're going to be short the next budget cycle. So I think that'll be certainly a struggle.
That's overall.
Correct.
Short in budget overall, yeah.
Yeah, so if we can find money to reallocate, perhaps, but that'll be part of the discussions with the governor. And he may ask for more or less. I don't know.
I have no idea. That's just going by the last 4 years.
Yep.
Let's talk about pensions for just a moment. It was dealt with. There was some reform made, but there still is a huge debt in what we pay for pensions for former educators and former state workers. You probably have a better idea. I mean, I think the last figure I saw was like $65 billion. It's higher than that.
It is. It's like 72 to 75, depending on which numbers you use.
And that's billion with a B.
A B, correct.
So even though there were reforms for looking for the future, it still is really not being dealt with to pay that down. How do we do that?
Well, I think that that's part of repurposing the money from other areas in the budget that perhaps are funding programs that aren't working. For too long, I think the budgeting approach has been, the budget's done simply by looking at the programs and saying, okay, everybody gets a 1.8% increase or whatever across the board. And then there's certain targeted investments such as education, like we talked about earlier. I think we really need to start looking at, and there were some budgetary reforms that passed out of the House, some that were signed into law regarding how that approach would be. And as you free up money elsewhere in the budget for programs that perhaps no longer meet their original intent, I think that that money has to be redirected back to those areas to help pay that down, because it's not going away. And that debt is substantial. And I think that it'll take a couple more years before the new plan, we actually start to see a lot of the cost savings from that. The cost inflection point's about 4 to 5 years out, probably, if you believe everybody's estimates, based on...
Inflection point. What do you mean?
Well, that's
that
where...
we actually see a difference, not the entire $70 billion.
Correct, yes. That's the point in time where the savings will start to be freed up.
Okay.
Because it takes a little bit of a lead time to build the new pension system and to build the new 401k style system. So that's about years 3 to 5, depending on how the markets perform and how the money goes based on the estimates when we passed it. And we have to check in every year and see if that's still the case. But at that point, the cost curves kind of they cross over, and we can start to have actual savings to the system that will then fund that. In the meantime, however, I mean, our economy is going very well. Our revenues are about $330 million ahead currently. And with that in mind, I would certainly love to see more of that money put in the rainy day fund. Part of being financially prepared is having an emergency fund. That's what that is. The other part, I think we should absolutely focus on paying that down, because there's a huge cliff in a little over 15 to 20 years, depending on performance. And as that drops off, the system will be funded, and then there'll be a huge drop off in costs. And we need to make sure that that we get that as close to now as possible.
A couple other issues, and I have about 5 minutes left. I'm going to try to cover
as
many as I can. Last week, Governor Wolf announced the formation of a commission that would look at redistricting for congressional boundaries in the state. Your caucus wasn't real pleased with it. In fact, the initial reports were you weren't going to cooperate with it. Why not? I mean, I have to say that for 10 years of being involved in this program, this is an issue that I say this very often, that 5 years ago, if I would have said to someone on the street, let's talk about congressional redistricting, the eyes would glaze over and they change the subject. Today, this is something that people who are engaged, it is a big issue with them. Why not cooperate with the governor? What's going to happen to make sure that redistricting is more fair?
Well, I'll give you a little bit of background on myself. I didn't support the last maps, the ones that were thrown out as unconstitutional by the court. You can go back on my website and see my statement on it. And I had major concerns about the way the lines were drawn, specifically the district that everybody called, I think it was Goofy Kicking Donald.
Yeah, because in Chester County and all.
Correct.
That, yeah.
Well, it came the whole way over into Lancaster County, which is why I objected to it. And so that's kind of my background. So do I agree that there should be a different process? Yes. Unfortunately, what we've had up to this point are the two branches of government that are not constitutionally delegated to deal with reapportionment, both the judiciary and the executive branch, giving their input. Input's great. That's part of the legislative process. But I'm not sure that the governor's executive order will be particularly helpful in resolving this debate. Last session, we had a proposal come out of the Senate. We tried to move a proposal out of committee. I was on the Rules Committee. Leader Reed moved it. And so I voted for moving that to the floor. And unfortunately, there were 400 Democrat amendments and about 180 to 200 Republican amendments that went on it. That's part of the legislative process, and we have to plow through those amendments. Personally, I would welcome the governor's help in plowing through those amendments, getting them pulled off the bill, because that, to me, is how the legislature speaks. It speaks based on what we vote on. Mm-hmm. So in that regard, I think that we need to continue to pursue it, but I think it has to be in the right forum, because what ultimately changes redistricting is a new law.
But, okay, you say that what the governor did is not helpful. We only have a minute or so left. But not participating in the commission, is that helpful?
I think it's really a question of constitutional authority. The commission, while it goes around and takes in comments, he can provide input through his commission just like any other constituent, in my opinion. And in that regard, I think that we are better served by focusing on actually getting a bill done.
You know that there would be people listening to that and say that's a technicality, that or falling back on constitutional authority when it sounds like you don't want to get something done.
Well, the Constitution is our foundational document. And while they can claim that it's a technicality, the truth is it is the governing document.
Representative Brian Cutler, the new majority leader in the state house, can we have you back?
And absolutely.
I mean, we only covered three or four issues, but there's a lot to talk about. And I know it really time flies, doesn't it? Representative Cutler, the new House Majority Leader, thank you very much for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, and look forward to coming back.
And we will be at the governor's residence on Friday. Governor Wolf will be on the program. We can talk about many of these same issues.